Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Chapter 29, Careers Advice. "But why haven't you got oculomancy lessons anymore?" said Hermione, frowning. "I've told you," Harry muttered. "Snape reckons I can carry on by myself now I've got the basics." "So you've stopped having funny dreams?" said Hermione skeptically. "Pretty much," said Harry, not looking at her. I'm Matt Potts.
And I'm Vanessa Zoltan.
And this is Harry Potter and the Sacred Text.
Matt, we are lucky enough to be joined today by a special guest, Delphine Mooney, who is the executive director of On the Rise. We are partnering again this year with On the Rise, which is an amazing daytime shelter that works with people who are experiencing homelessness. And Delphine, can you just remind our listeners what the work of On the Rise is, please?
Yeah, thank you again for inviting me back. You know, I'm just in this seat as ED for over 2 years now, and I've served in a lot of different capacities, but I've seen this community change and grow in so many ways over the years, and I feel really grateful to be a part of it and to talk about it. So On the Rise emerged as the result of feedback from unhoused women who shared that their needs were not being met by programs that existed to assist them. And recognizing these gaps, we adopted a unique, low-threshold, relational approach to addressing homelessness that provides immediate necessities like food and showers every day, but also works to build the foundation people need to address more complex and long-term issues. And so since our founding, we've expanded our service population to include gender diverse individuals moving through and beyond homelessness. But really what sets us apart is our enduring commitment to supporting folks even after they've secured housing. And that long-term commitment is so special because it's really the relationship that creates a sense of security for folks who are dealing with complex issues. And those issues range anywhere from healing trauma stemming from abuse, reconnecting with lost family, or addressing mental and physical health needs. And the relationships are what connects us. You know, they allow us to respect differences and discover common ground and build community. And we consider them transformative. So what that means is they're genuine, they're mutual, they're safe and enduring. And so building trusting relationships that are nurtured over time is really central to the work of On the Rise.
You know, Delphine, On the Rise is such an amazing program. After last year's Don't Be a Dursley campaign, when this podcast supported On the Rise, I got our church involved in supporting On the Rise. And so now we provide meals regularly, just like Vanessa and her family does. And any of our listeners who are in the Boston or Cambridge area, if you want to get directly involved and build some of these relationships, please do look into it. But there's a program coming up you have called Empty Bowls. Could you tell us more about what Empty Bowls is?
Yeah, we are celebrating the 11th annual Empty Bowls Project. And this was not an original idea of ours. I think it originated in the South. But on March 23rd and 24th, we have a two-day event this year. Local potters have generously donated their beautiful works of art. And we also have a collection of fantastic community-minded restaurants who donate delicious soup. And you buy a ticket, you are entitled to select the bowl of your dreams, an exquisite masterpiece, and also receive a helping of delicious soup that ranges from, you know, we've got vegan options, vegetarian options, gluten-free, and it's really just a beautiful kind of gathering of the community and kind of a showing of the artistic talent and culinary talent of locals to support On the Rise.
Well, Delphine, I know that you mentioned that one of the most powerful parts of your work is the community that On the Rise builds. And so we invited you to tell a story on that theme today. I was wondering if you could tell us your story.
Yeah. You know, I think part of the grounding for us in the space that we work is really recognizing that homelessness is incredibly isolating. And so on top of, you know, likely being disconnected from family and friends, we live in a world that is often ready to ascribe undesirable circumstances to someone's personality or character, when in fact, they often have fallen victim to something or someone and were not caught by the social safety nets already in place. And we tend to separate ourselves from those living through those type of circumstances because we want to tell ourselves that it couldn't happen to us. And that type of ostracization and stigmatization really is what deprives an already very vulnerable population of a central component of health, which is human connection. You know, we all need it. We all need community, especially at those times when things are really tough. It is the difference between stabilizing your life or your situation and your life potentially going into a tailspin. So we believe in providing a safe and enduring community, and staff are really on the front lines of combating that type of loneliness. And one of the ways that we do that, beyond kind of the social connectedness that is a component of what our organization fosters on a daily basis, is we have a number of community events sprinkled throughout the year that are meant to foster relationships and build community. And one of those events, if you haven't been to On the Rise, we're located in a big Victorian house right in the heart of Cambridge, Massachusetts. And in our outdoor space, we have a memorial garden, which has stones engraved with the names of people in our community, both housed and unhoused, who have passed away over our 27-year history. And, you know, as I was reflecting, I was thinking back to the event in 2022. So each year the community gathers and we share stories about the people who've passed away in that year. We are able to invite a celebrant who comes to incorporate some kind of spiritual element to the ceremony. And it's very peaceful and it offers a space for participants to grieve in community. This ceremony historically was born out of participants' concerns about being forgotten once they've passed away. And in 2022, we hadn't had the chance to gather for almost 2 years at that point, 3 years since the pandemic struck. And, you know, tragic and unexpected death is very familiar to our community, and which makes it even more important for us to gather and remember those who have passed away. And this was particularly true during COVID because we just lost so many people during the course of those couple of years. And so there were so many people who reached out to us to ensure that someone they knew within On the Rise's community was remembered at this event. And it was really the first time that we had seen a lot of folks since the pandemic had struck. And many people expressed to us that day that they were so grateful to know that the event was able to come back into being because it was so important to them to be remembered, but also to be able to have a place to gather together. And it's a very peaceful and beautiful space that we have physically to remember folks. But 2022 was a little different in that because there were so many folks to remember, we had to amend the ceremony slightly. And so we recognized everyone's name with a chime and were able to kind of collectively symbolize the group by doing a butterfly release. But it really struck me how many folks came up to us to really appreciate the time to get together and to remember people and how important it was to them in their lives to know that they would be remembered by On the Rise in this way. We really want to be a community for folks, and especially the population we work with who express being invisible and forgotten on a regular basis in their daily lives. Being able to ensure that they are getting that is a big piece for us and really affirms our community.
And part of what I love about that, Delphine, is that people who have passed away can still be part of our community. Like, we need community who is with us on this earth at the same time, but also that doesn't mean that people who have impacted us, who have passed, aren't still part of our community. And I just love that you're sure to honor people in that way.
Yeah, it's so true. It also, you know, is a way to combat loneliness that on this earth people are feeling. And, you know, even the, I think the U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy described loneliness as an epidemic that's on par with tobacco use. And it's not difficult to imagine how loneliness impacts someone's depression or anxiety. And there's something that he said that really struck me about loneliness and how it resonates for me with the work that On the Rise does, is he talks about it being like hunger and thirst, and saying that it's like a natural signal that our body senses when we're lacking something we need for survival. And in this case, it's social connection. And so, you know, people are feeling that in life, but also they are feeling that in kind of remembering and wanting to bring those who've passed away into the fold. It's really about social connection.
You know, Delphine, one of the things I'm sure we're going to talk about in this episode when we reflect upon the meaning of community is just sort of like, how are people bound together in community? What binds people together? And the thing that's so special about your story and that On the Rise does so well is just think about memory, shared memory, as a way to bind one another, not just shared memory of a common past, but also that we remember each other, right? And it also just strikes me that's just behind so much of the work that On the Rise does from the outset. You're also remembering the people who maybe we as a larger society too easily forget. You're interested and engaged in the work of memory, of trying to combat loneliness, not just at the end of life, but in the midst of life and in drawing people into your community. So thank you so much for that work. And thank you for allowing us to partner with you to support that work.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to talk a little bit about what we do and for highlighting the work that we do. We're thrilled to be able to be out there and have a chance to have more people learn about what we do and who we are.
And if anybody wants to join me, I will be going to the Empty Bowls seating on Saturday, March 23rd at 1:30. So if you want to sign up, the link is in the show notes, but you can also just go to ontherise.org. You can go to the seatings when I'm not there also, but it'd be more fun if you came while I was there. Well, Matt, it is always such a pleasure to talk to Delphine, but it is also always such a pleasure to watch you stress about the 30-second recap.
I'm very calm. So, I haven't stressed in about 3/4 of a book, I think.
Well, I hope that me telling you I enjoy it will encourage you to stress.
Now I'm very stressed. Now I know you're paying attention to it.
Thank you. Okay, on your mark, get set, go.
So Hermione's like, you're not doing Occlumence anymore. And Harry's like, no, I don't need to. And she's like, really? And whatever. And then they go and they get Easter eggs, and the Easter eggs, and he says to Ginny, I want to talk to Sirius. And that can be arranged, Ginny says. And then he goes to Snape's not very nice. And then careers counseling. And in careers counseling, McGonagall and Umbridge argue, he can be an Auror, he can't be an Auror. And they're shouting when Harry leaves, and there's a big disruption, and there's a swamp everywhere. And he goes to the office, and he talks to Sirius and Lupin, and they say, we were jerks. And he's like, yeah, you kind of were. And he goes back to where Fred and George are, and they fly out of the ceiling and say, give her help. Peeves.
That was really good.
Thanks.
You're getting so good at this.
Thanks. But I was more stressed this time. since you called attention to it. Good. So thank you.
You did a good job and you are more stressed. Ugh, makes me so happy.
Okay, Vanessa, let me count you in. 3, 2, 1, go.
So Hermione gets accused of nagging because she's worried about Harry and the fact that he has just given up on studying occlumency. And sure, it's Snape's fault, but also Hermione is right. And they all have to go and they're thinking about the different careers that they can have. And some of them actually sound kind of fun, but Harry is like, I only want to be an Auror. And McGonagall's like, if it's the last thing I do, I will make sure that you can. But Ginny is like, same about that, but about talking to Sirius. And Fred and George help and they do a swamp and then they say, give him hell, Peeves. I got peeves in. You didn't get the word peeves in.
That's right. I just missed the word peeves. I think you were able to do so because you very, with an impressive amount of brevity, created the phrase, do a swamp.
Here's the thing.
It totally makes
Shakespeare.
Sense.
Shakespeare.
I know. It's the soul of wit. You got the idea across perfectly. And in 7 fewer seconds than it took me to say the same thing. So Vanessa, we're going to explore the theme of community in this chapter, and I thought we might start by a short visit to Etymology Corner.
My favorite corner.
So community comes from the word common, right? It's just like a collective noun variation of the word common. And common comes from a Proto-Indo-European root. The co means together, like that's familiar to us, right? Co, you co-write something, co-author something, you write it together, right? And then the second part of the word that starts with an M, they think the original word was may, and that meant to go or to move. So the deepest root of this word actually means like to move together, like to operate together. Right at the beginning of the chapter, Hermione comes to Ron and Harry and says, okay, exams are coming up. Here's what we Americans would call our study schedule, right? It's a timetable for revision. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's all plotted out and they are going to do it together. Like she knows that Harry and Ron would not have been as disciplined as she would be and would not have done this. So she gives it to them so they can move together and move successfully through this difficult time with one another. And to me, that sounds like moving together. That's an example of community. Where it gets more complicated between the three of these characters is later on in the chapter, which is in this chapter, as our 30-second recaps so clearly described. Harry is looking for a diversion so he can contact Sirius through the flu network. That diversion arises when Fred and George create a swamp and draw Umbridge and the Inquisitorial Squad and all the, you know, concerned authorities to that site so that Harry can get into Umbridge's office, to the one unsupervised fireplace, and use the flu network to communicate with Sirius. But it's a very risky thing, obviously. And here are a disagreement arises between the three. Harry is not sure what to do. Ron seems kind of reflective and finally says, you know, Harry has to decide. I can't decide for him. And Hermione also acknowledges that Harry has to decide, but she is way in on the side of deciding not to do this. It's too risky, right? So these three are not moving together, but I think everyone's thinking about community also, right? Like Hermione is thinking this is too risky to the movement, to Dumbledore's army, to the Order of the Phoenix, to everyone who wants to resist Umbridge. We need you in school here. That's what Dumbledore said. This is too risky. For the sake of the community, we need to decide that you will not do this. And I think, you know, there's one interpretation which you could say Ron is not thinking about the community. He's thinking about just whatever this individual wants. Like, Harry has to make a decision. He's an individual, so the decision is up to him. But I also think that he's understanding that, like, part of what's at stake in what they're doing is supporting Harry, right? That's part of what the community's interest is in supporting Harry as he goes through this time. And he just thinks that he has to grant this autonomy to Harry. Harry has to decide whether it's worth it or not. They can't make that decision for him. And so he wants to move together with Harry, with what Harry wants to do, right? Yeah, so I don't know if I have a question to follow on that summary of what happened or what I think is going on. But, I mean, whose side are you on? Ron or Hermione's?
Well, thank you for asking. It just depends on how you're defining what their goal is, right? If their goal is to, like, make sure that Harry is safe, then I could see that Hermione and Ron are actually both in community. They just have different ideas of what safety means.
Yep.
And Ron thinks like Harry's emotional and mental well-being is part of his safety, whereas Hermione probably doesn't disagree with that, but is like, well, his physical safety and like not being expelled is more important. So I do think that they're still in community. I really love this idea of community as being moving with. And I know that you agree with what I'm about to say, but I think that there can be disagreements within a community as to how to best try to achieve the goal or try how to best live up to the community standard that you have. And Ron and Hermione just have like a difference of opinion on the specifics here, but they're both being caring toward Harry.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's most telling about that is that Hermione is making this case as she walks alongside Harry, right? Like literally as she moves with him from class to class, she is making this case. And there is never a sense or a threat that if he decides something different than what she recommends, that she will abandon him. Right. And so like this,
it's not conditional.
That's right. They are still moving together. She's just trying to articulate what she thinks they as a whole need to do together. Right.
Right. Yeah. I do love, just as a side note, this has nothing to do with community, but the boys eventually start giving Hermione the silent treatment. And she's like, the silent treatment? Great. I have more airtime to keep making my point. And I'm just like, that is an opportunist if I've ever met one, Hermione. It's brilliant. I think it also makes sense, Matt, that Ron is able to stand in communal discordance with Hermione and Harry with so much confidence because he grew up in a family that, minus Percy, we'll put a big asterisk on Percy and deal with him another time. But other than that, this is clearly a family that is committed to unconditional love. And yet they are going about their life goals and the way that they walk through the world very differently, right? Molly would want each of her kids to graduate from Hogwarts, to get any WTs in as many classes as possible. And Fred and George are very much going their own way. But it's not, you know, if we're using your etymology and sort of thinking of it as a flying V of geese, like it's not, they're not flying in a different direction. Right? They're just like flapping their wings differently.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense to me that Ron is like, look, the three of us don't actually have to agree. Like, we don't need to form consensus on this. Harry can do what's best for him. You, Hermione, can disagree. I can like be on the fence about it and we're all okay. And we're all still part of the same V.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the other thing that's really so like endearing and lovely about the Weasleys is how like their actions, even in disagreement, tend to generate stronger bonds and make one another more courageous. So in the beginning of the chapter, Harry is in the library with Ginny and they get a package from Molly Weasley and it's full of Easter eggs. And one of the Easter eggs is for Harry because, as is so often the case, Harry is folded into the Weasley family when it comes to these sort of acts of kindness and support. And this act...
He's like a duck that's a part of their goose V.
That's right. And this egg moves Harry. This act of kindness moves Harry and is what gives him kind of the strength to articulate what he actually wants to Ginny, this thing he thinks is impossible, which is that he wants to speak to Sirius, right? Like one act of kindness kind of gives him the energy and or the courage to articulate what he needs to say. And Ginny says, well, maybe we can do that. Because one thing I've learned from Fred and George is that nothing is impossible if you're willing to be bold enough, right? And then Fred and George show up and they tell him and it just kind of unfolds and unfolds and unfolds. And then we have this situation where Harry ends up talking to Sirius and Fred and George, you know, as I'm sure we will talk about, have their kind of climactic exit from Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. But what's so interesting is like, I think with Fred and George also, like they feed off one another's courage, right? They can do this together. Neither of them is making this escape on their own or causing this diversion on their own. They have one another to lean on, just as Ginny has them to lean on, just as Harry has Ginny to lean on, just as, you know, Molly sends an egg that inspires Harry to be willing to make himself vulnerable and to ask for what he wants from these folks. So there is a sense of these folks working together or moving together in that ancient sense of the word community, even though everyone's doing a different thing. Like, Ginny's just listening. Molly sends an Easter egg. Fred and George create a swamp in the middle of the school. But all of them are figuring out a way to support Harry as he makes his way through this incredibly trying situation.
Yeah. I know I talk about this a lot, but my favorite sentence in the whole series is their presence was his courage, right? Mm. And it's about, you know, in book 7, when Lupin, Sirius, James, and Lily show up for Harry. But I think that we see it again and again throughout the series, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I am really fascinated about it in the twins in particular. But this scene is so interesting because it's a bit, like they're doing a comedy bit, but the way that they are doing their bit is in constantly checking in with one another. What do you think, George? Is it time for us to get out of here? I don't know, Fred. What do you think, right? Like, they are literally doing a call and response to one another. And I really do believe, like, these are two brilliant, hardworking, mischievous, warm-hearted kids, and neither of them would be half the person they are without the other one, right? Like, they together really are greater than the sum of their parts, because, like, they always have the presence of someone who can be their courage, right? Like, if there is a second that either of them falters, there's somebody there to keep them on point. And I love that, like, that confidence, you know, leads to Ginny. And I just also love that, like, the kindness of community. Sometimes it'll fall on deaf ears. Sometimes it'll be, you know, Ron not liking the sweater, whatever it is. But, like, sometimes it'll be, like, just the thing that can give you the courage to keep going.
Yeah, and in that sense, like, what goes on in this chapter is almost like a foreshadowing of the way that this group of children will win the Battle of Hogwarts with support of some adults, right? Which is that everyone ends up standing up for each other, being courageous for each other, not just standing up by themselves. I mean, individuals do undertake singular and single acts of courage. Like, we'll see Molly do that. We'll see Neville do this. But, like, the reason it works at the Battle of Hogwarts is because they are all standing up for each other, which is this idea of community, right? They draw their courage from one another's courage.
I think one of the things, Matt, that I love about thinking about the Weasleys in community is that they're all close to each other in different ways, right? Like, you don't get the sense that, like, Ginny and Charlie are close, but it doesn't matter, right? Like, I think that Ginny would do just as much for Charlie as she would for Fred and George, who she's obviously closer to, right? Like, there's something about community that makes it more than just about individual relationships or individual preferences, right? Yeah. It's like, we're part of the same thing and that matters. And, like, you know, I can be mad at you, but, like, that doesn't matter. We're part of the same community and therefore we've got each other's backs, which is why I find Draco really interesting in this chapter, Matt. Draco is such a jerk in this chapter, and just, like, for no reason. He's, like, barely been around. It's not like Harry is really, like, bothering him or whatever. And we only see Draco for a minute. But at the end of the chapter, Harry has actually done a pretty good job in potions because for the first time ever, Snape is ignoring him rather than abusing him. And he is about to turn in a good potion, which we've just found out is actually really important for his career, like being able to turn in a couple of good potions. And Draco intentionally knocks the potion over so that Harry can't turn it in. And I was just thinking about how Draco might not be part of a community. And I'm wondering what you think about that, because he thinks he's better than everyone. So I don't think he's, like, a part of Team Slytherin, right? Like, I think he prefers being in Slytherin than anything else, but I'm not sure that he's someone who, like, particularly cares about Slytherin. For the Quidditch team, he bought his way on, right? And, like, there's just, like, an asterisk by his name. And then his relationships with Crabbe and Goyle, right? Like, he's just the boss. There's, like, no equality. And I'm wondering what you think about, like, is it possible to have community where one person essentially has all of the control, right? Because, like, that just seems like a dynamic and potentially an incredibly unhealthy dynamic more than a community. And I'm wondering if part of why Draco is such a jerk all the time is because he doesn't have any community.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I mean, I guess it depends if you see a bad community as not a community, right? Like, which I can sure. totally see, right? If we're defining community as something positive, then I think a bad community isn't a community. I think that's what you're getting at, right? But if we're taking this kind of bare bones definition of you move together, right? I mean, I think a lot of what the Slytherin community is now, and certainly what the Death Eater community is and will be, is a community based on fear, right? You move together because you're afraid, either of what will happen to you or what will happen to others. That is definitely the way that Voldemort exerts power. And you can see that that trickles down to the way that notable families within his circle also operate and operate with one another. And that trickles down into the way that the Slytherins operate. And so, like, they do move together in that basic way, but I don't think that they build each other up. You know what I mean? What we were saying about the Weasleys is that, like, the sum of their courage adds up to more than the parts, right? Because their courage feeds off each other, builds one another. They actually grow into something more powerful than anyone individually is. I think, and this is why they lose at the end of the series, right? I think the opposite happens with communities based on fear, which is that we draw from each other. We make each other more scared, less courageous, less willing to risk for one another, less willing to stand up for one another, because we're mostly just scared of what's going to happen to us. And so, yeah, I think it's a community that has a lot of potential to fail. But the reason why it gets as far as it does, I think, is because fear is a really great motivator. Yeah. I mean, it's not a healthy motivator, and it's not a kind one, but it can be a useful one. And we see in this book and in forthcoming books how effective it can be when you're able or willing to really wield fear ruthlessly to try to get people to move together, right?
Yeah, I hate it. I really got reminded about how much I hate Draco in this chapter.
Yeah.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
You mentioned Draco, and Draco becomes part of this inquisitorial squad in this chapter that supports Umbridge as she tries to enforce all her rules around the school. One of the things that really struck me at the end of this chapter, in that final climactic scene that I mentioned when Fred and George are about to fly out of the building, is, you know, the whole school has gathered. All the authorities or whatever have gathered to punish Fred and George. And then the other teachers have gathered just to see what's going on. And all the students, whether loyal to Umbridge or loyal to Dumbledore or indifferent, they've all gathered in this single space. The whole school is there. And I just had this mental image in my head of, like, here is the Hogwarts community.
Yeah,
we have one sense of community, which is just like, here are the people who are part of Hogwarts and they're all in one place. But then, especially as the text describes it, you can see the inquisitorial squad standing together in one place, and you see other members of different houses standing together. We also have these internal divisions within the community, sub-communities within the community. It just got me thinking about how every community is also made up of people who are moving against or moving alongside or moving backwards or whatever. It's not always just moving together, right? Communities are made up of sub-communities and individuals who are resisting or pressing or turning or refusing or whatever. And we see that in the Hogwarts community in this final scene.
And you could even imagine someone saying, like, we're not in community together. We just, like, live in the same castle.
Yeah, right.
Like, I'm not in community with the people in my apartment building. Whereas other, you know, to some extent, community is a feeling. And I remember the first night of freshman orientation when I was a proctor in my 30s living with 18-year-olds. The first night they would have this, like, cheering competition where every, like, floor would see who could cheer the loudest. And my floor never did well because I could not quite get myself to encourage them to just like feel like a community because they all lived on the same floor, right? Like I was like, yeah. We will become a community by like promising to each other that we're going to respect each other's like space and quiet and, you know, like, and we're going to do study breaks and get to know each other. But like right now we're just a group of people who were all assigned to live somewhere. And I know that other people really are like, okay, like we've been assigned to live somewhere together. Like that's it. We're now a community.
Yeah.
And I've just always been really resistant to that. Yeah, I love thinking about this because absolutely, like you go through something together. Like it's very easy from the outside to see that this is a unique community. There are only a couple of hundred students in this space in this moment. And yet also, like, I don't know, they all just live in the same castle.
Yeah, I think that's fair. So Vanessa, now it's time for our weekly sacred reading practice. And this week we are continuing our practice of Lectio Divina, which originates in Christian medieval practices of reading the Bible. It's a four-stage process, and we are going to pick a line at random from the chapter and go through this four-stage process. So I have randomly selected a line from the chapter, and here it is. Professor Umbridge's smile vanished as suddenly as a light bulb blowing.
Oof.
So in the first step of Lectio Divina, we just talk about what's literally going on in the chapter. Like when this line occurs in the chapter, what is literally going on? Do you remember, Vanessa?
Yes, Matt. This is in one of the most satisfying scenes in the entire series, I would argue. And that is when Harry and McGonagall are having their careers advice meeting, but Umbridge has invited herself to sit in. And so they have been talking about how Harry wants to be an Auror, and McGonagall is like, well, it's a good thing that you're really good at defense against the dark arts. And Umbridge is like, no, he's not. And McGonagall is like, I'm sorry, he's been good with every competent teacher. You haven't liked him. But you're horrible. That was subtext. And then Professor Umbridge's smile vanished as suddenly as a light bulb blowing.
That's a great summary. It's a great line from McGonagall.
I should have made my meaning plainer. He has achieved high marks in all defense against the dark arts tests set by a competent teacher.
That's right. That's a great summary, Vanessa. So step two of Lectio Divina is to reflect upon what this reminds us of in other cultural texts or other areas of culture.
Matt, my family is in the middle of watching Hitchcock movies. My 11-year-old has become obsessed with Alfred Hitchcock. And so we watched North by Northwest over the weekend. And there is a relationship between Cary Grant and Ava Marie Saint. And he thinks that they're in love. And then it turns out she's a spy for the other side. Just like that, you're not who I thought you were. Like,
interesting.
He goes from being like, I'm in love with you, to being like, you're a traitor and I'm heartbroken. What about you, Matt?
That's interesting. That's a nice emotional association. I'm just going for like what's right on the surface, which is the light bulb blowing.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Blowing makes me feel like it blew up, right? And it reminds me of the movie The Natural, which is not a movie I've seen recently. I think I saw it as a kid. But I just know,
based on the Bernard Malamud novel.
That's right. And I know at the end of the movie, at least, when Robert Redford hits the home run with a different bat, because the bat he has used all the time has just broken. Which, by the way, listeners, that's not the way bats work in Major League Baseball these days. They go through like a bat a day. They break these bats all the time. Anyway, Robert Redford, in like his last at bat ever, hits a home run and the ball goes up into the lights. And hits the lights, and a shower of sparks fall on him as he rounds the bases. It's very dramatic. When I think of light bulbs blowing in American popular culture, I think of the end of The Natural.
I love both of these answers because this is a celebratory moment for McGonagall, right? Like Umbridge's smile vanishing, yeah, like a light bulb blowing, is an awesome moment for McGonagall. Yeah. And then also this, like, I thought we were on the same team. I don't think that Umbridge like thought she and McGonagall were like besties, but I think she thought that McGonagall was going to like maintain professionalism.
Or at least respect her authority, right?
Exactly.
Yep.
And in this moment, I think you and I would both agree that what McGonagall does here is awesome and is like respecting a bigger authority, which is like believing in a child's education. But right. I think that we did a great job with step two.
I agree. I can't wait to see what we do with the next two steps. Vanessa, step three of Lectio Divina is we speak about what this reminds us of in our own lives. Mm-hmm. Have you ever hit a home run that has knocked out a light bulb and showered sparks upon you as you rounded the bases?
I'm trying to think of moments where I've been like smiling and I got a piece of news and I was like, oh, never mind. I mean, Matt, what it reminds me of, I've been thinking about this lately and I'm not sure why. There was one night when I was doing my clinical pastoral education in an emergency room and the social worker had clocked out. For some reason, I was the person who called someone to tell them that their son had gotten into a motorcycle accident. Hmm. And it's the only time I ever had to give that news.
Yeah.
And just like dialing the number, being like keenly aware that no matter what was going on with this person, I was about to make their life like infinitely worse, right? Like there really just becomes this like heady thing where you're like, every second they don't know is another second that they have peace. This was almost 10 years ago, and I just remember it so vividly, you know, being handed the phone number by the nurse and being told what the person's name was, like all of it. And yeah, just like having to give that news, knowing that I was effectively like blowing up their light bulb. That's what it reminds me of.
Yeah, this is reminding me of something that happened in lecture a few weeks ago. My lecture style is not unlike my podcast host style, which is I think I generally have like a warm and cheery tone. But also kind of like podcast host style, I also will kind of abruptly speak about very dark or sad things. And I just noticed in lecture a couple weeks ago, I can't remember the exact example, but I was saying some things and people were chuckling and I just kind of dropped something kind of heavy and one person laughed in the room. And I was like, sorry, that was serious. And I felt like bad because I was like, I don't blame you for laughing because obviously the momentum of this paragraph was, here's something that's not too heavy. And then I ended it with a very heavy thing. It just reminds me of that moment where it was just kind of like, oh, smile vanishing really suddenly in the room. Matt Potts just flicked off the light of happiness in here. And I kept smiling by mistake. I would like to withdraw my chuckle. That's what it's reminding me of. If that person is listening, Matt, I do not blame you for your chuckle. I know it's my fault. Vanessa, step four of Lectio is we reflect upon what this line is calling us to do in our lives. What is this calling you to do?
It makes me feel called to like not being scared to say the thing that's going to make other people's smile vanish or the other way around, right? Like life is complicated. I think that even amongst like sadness, we should take the levity where we can find it. And then also I think amongst levity, this is just like a very Jewish thing, right? Like you break a glass at the wedding to remind yourself that on the happiest days, like there's still destruction in the world. You know, pour out part of your wine at Seder. Every celebration in Judaism is cut by acknowledgement that there is suffering in the world.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just like, I don't know. I feel fine about that. Like,
yeah.
Every once in a while, telling people something that'll break their smiles.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I don't blame the person for chuckling in my classroom, but I think that's also why I talk that way is like, if you can only laugh when you pretend the world isn't suffering, then you shouldn't laugh.
Right, exactly.
You kind of have to see the world as it is. What this has me thinking about with this line is, I'm gonna lead us on a little journey.
Ooh.
You know, there's this adage that a smile brightens a room, right? You can see the association in this line between a smile and light, but Umbridge's smile is not a genuine smile, right? What's happening here is like the smile is vanishing because it was never really there. There's not actual joy beneath it. There's not happiness beneath it. And that's why the light goes out, right? I think that, yeah, so maybe it's connected to what you were saying. Like to be able to smile in face of darkness is actually what brightens the room, not to smile as a way to pretend it's not there or something. In The Plague by Albert Camus, two of the characters, when the plague is raging, they decide to go for a swim, their friends. And they're two of the like the frontline workers in this plague in the city, the name of which I can't even remember now, this fictional city. But they decide to go for a swim, and one character smiles to the other. And the way that Camus describes it, it says, it's a smile that forgot nothing, not even murder.
Mm.
Right? Like, this smile was not one that's pretending the world is not as bad as it is, but can take joy in this moment, despite the fact that the world is as it is. And that's a real genuine smile. That is a smile that does give light in the midst of darkness, rather than pretend that there's light or give the illusion of light in the midst of darkness.
Always good to remind us of Camus. Well, Matt, thank you so much for that really beautiful Lectio Divina.
Thank you, Vanessa.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Our voice memo this week is from Janie.
Hi, you all. I'm a longtime listener, but have been waiting for the perfect opportunity to bless Ginny Weasley. And after listening to your episode on the St. Mungo's chapter from book 5, it just really felt like the right time. You guys talked about how Ginny is the one to receive Arthur's hug when he's in the hospital. And I, like Ginny, am the youngest in my family. I have 3 older brothers, so, you know, not the same as 5, but similar. And I think it's really easy for people to see the times that being the youngest and being the only girl is really great. You know, in times of crisis, I would be the only one in my family to receive a hug from my parents, even if my brothers didn't. But it's a little tougher, I think, if you haven't lived it, to see the hard parts. And so much of why Ginny's my favorite character is because I really look up to the way that she handles the hard parts of being the youngest in her family and of being the only girl. I think anyone who has any kind of separation from their siblings, whether it's, you know, a big age gap or a difference in interests or gender or whatever it may be, can really look to Ginny and see how she just fiercely advocates for herself. She doesn't let excluding her be even on the table as an option. She is confident in her position as a really important member of the Weasley family, and she cultivates strong relationships with all of her brothers. And as I've read and reread these books, seeing Ginny do this has given me so much confidence to do the same and has strengthened my relationships with everyone in my family. So blessings for Ginny and blessings for all little siblings.
Thank you, Ginny, for that lovely voice, Memo, and for being such a great younger sibling. The half of Vanessa and I that are younger siblings are grateful for this blessing, and the half that are older siblings are also grateful for our younger siblings and for the blessing that they are to us. So thank you.
It is now time for us to remember members of our community who have been loved and lost. Reem Nabhan, who is 3 years old, a beloved daughter, granddaughter, and sister. Tarek Naban, who was 5, a beloved brother, son, and godson. Sherry Lee Beck, who was 84, a grandmother, mother, wife, and friend to anyone she met. May their memories be a blessing to us all. Matt, we now offer blessings to characters in the chapter. Who are you blessing?
You know, Vanessa, I'm going to follow Janie's lead, and I'd like to bless Ginny. Ginny is the one who kind of starts everything rolling in this chapter. She's with Harry when the box of Easter eggs comes. She's there to receive Harry's emotion and vulnerability, and also the one to suggest, like, you know, nothing's impossible when you've got the Weasleys on your side.
Mm-hmm.
And she's right. She's right to have that opinion, and she's right to share it with Harry. And all that happens in the rest of this chapter really comes down to her making these connections. So Ginny's instrumental, as in so many things in these books, but in this chapter in particular. So I wanted to bless her this week. Who are you blessing?
I love that. Nothing's impossible when the Weasleys are on your side. I am blessing Hermione because there was a moment that we talked about earlier in which Draco spills Harry's really good potion. And so he's like, Harry's about to go back to his cauldron to, you know, get a little bit of the potion that's maybe left at the bottom of it. But Hermione has already cleaned his cauldron. And she's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, Harry. And I just want to say, Hermione, there's nothing to be sorry for. That's such a beautiful gesture that you just like clean up on your way out the door. And I just want to know everything about this. Like, is she always cleaning up after Ron and Harry? Or like, do they not really have to clean up and she just has a second so she's able to? I don't know what it is, but I just know that she probably feels so bad, even though she was just doing a very kind thing. So I want to offer a blessing for kind things that have gone wrong. It doesn't make them less kind.
Next week, we're going to be reading Book 5, Chapter 30, Grawp, through the theme of determination with the wonderful Jackson Bird.
Just a few reminders before we give our thanks, everybody. Please contribute to our Don't Be a Dursley campaign. You can find out more about that by going to harrypottersacredtext.com and donating to our fundraiser for On the Rise.
This has been a Not Sorry production, and Not Sorry Productions is a feminist production company. Our executive producers are Caitlin Hoffmeister and Vanessa Zoltan. We are edited and produced by AJ Yaramas. Our music is by Ivan Paisau and Nick Bull, and we are distributed by Acast. Thanks this week to Janie for their voicemail, to Ariana Nettleman, Julia Argy, Margaret H. Willison, Nikki Zoltan, Hannah Rehack, Casper Terkyle, Courtney Brown, Natalie Folkerts, Stephanie Paulsell, and everyone who sent in the names of those they have loved and lost this week. Can I count you in?
Count sure. You in? I don't I have a tongue
I
to
said
add.
A Michigan N. Michiganders Ooh, pronounce their I's. Like? Michiganders pronounce their I's very long, like short E's. I said, can I count you N? That's not the way it's pronounced. It's
yes,
in.
You can.
Can I count you in? Okay, can wow. I count you in? That, well, that was too
Please
high-pitched
do.
Then. And I went falsetto. Can I count you in? No, okay. Can I count you in?
Are you sure you're ready?
Now
to
I'm in
this
my
time?
Head. Can I count you in? Can I count you in? Can I count you in? I can't. What's my motivation here, AJ? What's my motivation? I don't.